Attention, please. Places for top of show. Places for top of show. Hello, and welcome to Twins Talk Theater. We are Cindy.
And Stacy.
And we're talking about theater, backstage life, and all the excitement that the audience doesn't get to see.
Enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. I know normally we don't do a little intro before a podcast, but just wanted to let you know that we were having some sound issues on this one due to computers being slow and internet, and we lost Cindy a couple times, but we're working on all of that. We're getting a new computer, we're getting some new software, so hopefully we don't have this issue in the future. But we hope you enjoy our Rusty's podcast, and let us know what you think. Thank you. Today we're talking to Orestes Acuni. He is the director for one of the current shows I'm working on, Picasso at Lupino Gil at the Palos Verdes Performing Arts. And it's the first time I've worked with Orestes, but so far it's been great. Let's see, we started rehearsal last week, we open next week. So it's kind of a quick process, but Orestes, Chris Gilbert, I, a number of other people have been meeting for the last probably 2 months on designs and ideas and rehearsal space and all that. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So as you were talking about a little earlier when we were setting up microphones and all, you do a lot of different things. I feel it's a very artsy, most arts people don't stay in one area forever or for too long. How did you get into theater or the arts or movies or anything like that?
It's an interesting question because, you know, the easy and quick answer is, like many people, it started kind of in the high school years. But if I really think about it and I trace it back, even in elementary school, if we put on a school play, I was the narrator. There's always a role somewhere for me in that. But I started considering it seriously as a profession, as a sidestep to something else, which is, I always thought I'd go into politics. I mean, as a young person, I was interested in politics, I was interested in law, I was interested in government, civics. So the idea of theater was, this is a way for me to be comfortable in front of large groups of people. This was a way for me to develop a public speaking skill and be able to kind of read a room. And as time went on, I found myself more drawn into the psychology and exploration of an author's work and how they viewed the people in the world and how they set these relationships up. I come from a point of view where most of my work is informed by the fact that I believe our relationships are pretty much all we have. So it makes theater and film a natural outlet for that, because that's the exploration. It comes through the relationship. So these concepts are revealed through how people interact and what makes people tick and where the conflicts are and where the resolutions are and where we overlap. And a lot of this is revealed through relationship. So that's, for me, artistically, I start with from that point of view, which is relationship.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, we put a lot of focus, as I do, technical theater, on what the set looks like and all that. But without the actors on stage relating to the audience or relating to each other or figuring out something about themselves, then it's not much of a play. I mean, it's a pretty picture we painted on stage, but even that has meaning on, you know, whose bar is it in Picasso's Lupino Gil? Who works at this bar? Who decorated the bar? Who comes to the bar and how they relate with each other and the set?
But the bar is a character. I mean, the bar is for those that come there regularly. This is an important part of their life. In the same way that in Los Angeles, people sit in their cars and like that bubble of that car becomes their world. I've got a friend who does musical theater and said, I could never move to New York. And I said, why? That's the mecca of musical theater. And they said, because I need to sing in my car on the way to rehearsal. I can't do that in a 600 square foot studio. I can't do it on the subway and I can't do it walking on the street. I need to work in my car. So for that performer, that's their way into the world. And for them, that car and that relationship, that car is also an extension of the relationships that I was talking about. So the lights are maybe some of the inner monologue of the character at times, or it lets the audience kind of know where we're going emotionally. Same with sound and music. So when I say relationships, I don't strictly mean between people. I mean the relationship between somebody and something.
Okay. Twin, did you have anything to say in that since we were ignoring you?
The only thing I was interested in, well, not the only thing I'm interested in, but what I was interested in is how you thought you were going to go into politics and then didn't go into politics, went into theater instead. That's a very interesting transition for me.
I think you missed most of that then. He said he gets in front of people and he likes that.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of exploring somebody else's concept of relationship. So having the ability to explore an author's, whether it's Arthur Miller or whether it's Shakespeare or whether it's Steve Martin, you get to put yourself into a world is exploring a relationship. And that became infinitely more than going out into the world and trying to affect change myself in maybe a more direct way to explore some of the things. And as time goes on, that exploration then leads you down different paths and new opportunities present themselves. And, you know, being open to what that is, you find yourself at different places. I mean, you guys are on opposite coasts at this point. So my understanding is that you took an opportunity for whatever reason, whether it was based on an intellectual pursuit, an emotional pursuit, or just the need for change, you went somewhere else.
Yeah, I think for Cindy, she kept jumping farther and farther away. She went up to Stockton in Northern California for college. At the school, she went out to Cincinnati. And then after grad school, she was going to Broadway because that's, you know, what you do when you go into theater. And she had roommates at the time who were doing getting their doctorates out in New York. So she moved in with them out there and then fell in love, found a husband. He grew up out there, so she stayed out there, whereas I stayed closer to home. Went to University of Redlands, which was the same city basically that we grew up in. And then I just didn't go that far away. I started making friends, I got a job, and then I just stayed out here. So, yeah, she chased a dream and I found a job. Kind of the same thing.
I think that that's an interesting, you never quite know how things are going to play out. So I think that there's an element of you prepare for what you think you want, and you experience the world as it presents itself to you, and then there are decisions to make where those things take you is the journey of life and wherever you go. And then you have the ability to make some corrections. If you're not happy with those decisions, you can always come back, you know.
Yeah, find a new job, move to a different state, change careers or something like that. Yeah, I think one of the things that's also very different about Cindy and I is I have a house position. I stay here at the Norris. I've been here for 9 years now. I do take jobs outside and do other things, but Cindy has always jumped. Well, not always. She had a house position for, 2 years? But then she jumps from show to show, and that takes her all over the country. She's been out here to Long Beach. She was in Philadelphia not long ago. You were in Boston, 3 months ago?
In November.
That makes
Thanksgiving. Yeah.
I mean, that makes some level of sense to me, given the nature of your specificity within profession. So the demands of the individual shows as a somebody who's production managing and technical directing and in that world, it makes sense to have a home. It makes sense to have a through line by which you handle production. As a stage manager, it would also make sense to me that those opportunities would come in different arenas and there would be more jumping because the nature of every show is that it opens and it closes.
Yeah.
Right. There's no point to sit at an actual house if you go 6 weeks without a production going on, because then it's kind of wasted money on your part to, you know, or for the company to waste money having you sit there. I went out again. I wonder if. Okay, you guys keep talking. I can hear you, so as long as Kai's okay, I'll just keep listening to your conversation.
He's just going to cut you out completely.
Well, I'll try to answer as if maybe you threw something at me, and I'll just make it up.
Yeah, text it, and I'll be like.
You can fill in the question later.
Exactly.
He was talking. Maybe if I had asked him this might have been the answer. It's kind of how my brain works anyway.
That's how most of us are jumping all over the place. So, Rusty, you're a director, but you don't have like a house position anywhere or any other titles?
In fact, it's interesting that you know, because my background is very eclectic within the world of theater and film. I as I said before, there's a level of precision and there's a level of interest that I have found it difficult to stay in one place. So there used to be, I would be working in theater in any capacity, and I would dream about film. Didn't matter what I was working on, I'd be dreaming about film. And then I would have the experience of working in film, and I'd be thinking about all the limitations of film and the expansion of theater. It was always that sense of like, it's the grass is always greener somewhere else. And because of that, I started as an actor, and I still consider myself as an actor. But along the way, I found teaching positions, writing positions, directing positions, producing positions. And this is a return to directing for me. It's been some time, actually, since I've worked as a director. It's something I've always done, and even in other capacities, I've found my way into directing. But as the labeled program director, it's been a while.
So following on that, you consider yourself an actor and a director and a number of different things. How do you... You don't have a house position. You go from show to show and different things. How do you decide if you want to direct a show or if you want to act in a show or what your next project is?
In some ways, I am fortunate in the lack of offers. So I take what comes. I mean, no, seriously. I think there's something to be said for that. I think there is something to be said for. There are people who are in a position where they say no is the most powerful word that they could, you know, ever speak. So that no is the most powerful statement that they can make, setting limits. And I think you have to earn that. And I'm a guy that says yes. So I usually will jump in. I try to get as much information as I can. I mean, the previous artistic position I had before this was I produced a $250,000 budget film. So, and that was the first time I had ever produced film. I stepped into it as one of several producers, but I saw the project from development with the writer-director through post-production, which is also kind of rare for the first time. So I was a developmental producer, then I was involved in production, and then I was involved in post and also distribution. So, but I didn't know what I was doing. And I think that that's okay. I think you say like, I have the ability to do this. I'm going to trust that I'm smart enough that if I have a question, I'll figure out who to ask that question to that can answer it. And I will go out in search of answer to this question, and I will do the best job that I can possibly do, given my skill set, given my enthusiasm and my desire to do a good job. And more often than not, that's enough.
Yeah, I feel like that itself is a good trait to have. It's the people who either think they know everything, so they don't actually know much, or they are not willing to ask for help or learn how to do things, is great. I love when crew people come in and they want to be here and they want to learn and they want to do the best show possible. That's much better than somebody who has been doing it for 30 years and knows everything. Cause at least I'm like, ooh, you're excited about the same project I'm excited about, and we're going to work together on this cool project.
Yeah. And if I think you lose that idea of like, I'm excited to work on this project, it's kind of time to take a break.
Yeah. Very true. I wonder if that's, I feel it's easy to get caught up in that though.
It's very
not step back and look at what you actually want, especially when you get older and you're like, well, I'm supposed to be, you know, have a steady career. I need to pay bills, especially when you get married, have kids, have a house. And a lot of people find themselves not happy, but they don't know why or what they're supposed to do or be able to stop and look at themselves and do something different.
Well, I think that also speaks to expectations. I come from a large family. I have one brother and three sisters. And I think for a long time, my parents thought, okay, so you're pursuing this creative life and this world in the arts, so much potential. You know, my parents think the world of me. They've always been very supportive of all of us. But, you know, they've said like, you know, one of my sisters got in on the ground floor of developing a company. Another one's a writer. Another one, you know, found his way to journalism. Another one's in education. And my parents, I think they always looked at me and said, you can do anything you want. Like, you have the potential to go out there and be successful in this image, in this two cars in the garage, mortgage paid, and, you know, have a little bit of a discretionary financial fund to go travel or, you know, find a passion that way. And what I think they realized is that as my siblings got married and had children and houses and pools and nice things that they were able to achieve in their life, working 70 hours a week, commuting into New York, train, having to sell their places in Manhattan because even a successful New Yorkers couldn't afford put their kids in a decent school. So I had to move to this. It became this cycle of, wait a minute, not all of this is what it's cracked up to be.
Yeah. There's a lot of stipulations and stresses that come with that.
And there are successes in maybe keeping your life more simple if you choose that. Maybe saying, you know, I'm not out in the woods chopping wood. I'm not, you know, without technology or anything like that. But, you know, my life's a little more streamlined. It's a little simpler. And it has its own stresses, but the money, the family, the steady job is not a fix to life's question for everyone.
Yeah, that's a good point. A lot of people think, well, that your goal in life is to get married, have kids, and have money.
And it's like, for some people. And it also works for some people. I know people who are happy. You know, and people always say, I'm not sure I know anybody who, you know, unmarried people always say, I'm not sure I know anybody who's happily married. Well, no, I mean, it's like anything else. You have to work at it. It's difficult. But I know plenty of people who are happily married. My folks are still happily married. My siblings are happily married. But it's work. And it's, if you want to put that work in, you can be successful at it. And if that's your life's pursuit, and I saw that was a big part of their life's pursuit. We would like to marry, have a family, raise children, go to the school functions, work outside jobs as adults that have nothing to do with children. Like they worked that balance. So for everybody, the balance is different. I don't say one is right and one is wrong. I just say this is where I'm at and this is kind of where I found myself, which is not entirely where I expected to find myself.
I think that all wraps kind of back around to your talking earlier about the relationships and how everything is relationships, and no, even a relationship that is very meaningful still work. Like you said, it's not like you get married and that's the end. It's like, no, every day there's issues that you have to deal with together and with each other and anything like that. And it's, the relationship is an ongoing thing that you have to work on and build.
And what's interesting, I think, also about relationships, as long as, you know, we've circled back, is I was explaining this to somebody recently. I was fortunate enough to know my grandparents into their older years, into their 80s and 90s in some cases. And it was nice to know them as adults because the relationship was able to continue in a different way. So,
well, same with, I feel, with parents. Get to know differently than you.
But even after they passed, I've often said, like, I got enough time with my grandfather to know what he would think of my girlfriend.
That's pretty cool.
Who he is, who he was, what he meant to me, and how he would respond to things, whether it's about changing a tire on a car or whether it was about cleaning, you know, clams for a, you know, clam sauce. I know him well enough to know his point of view, and I can hear his cadence, that Brooklyn cadence in his speech. And I know how he'd respond because I know the things that were important to him because I took the time to develop that relationship. So that relationship continues for me 12, 15 years after he passed away.
I'm sure he really likes that because none of us obviously have died, but I feel like it would be hard not knowing, you know, what will happen and not being able to be there and watch the people you care about grow. So yeah. Probably loves to know that you still hear him in your head and you still feel that he's around and there and relationship powerful.
Yeah, and that's again part of what we take with us. We were just downstairs looking at the set on the stage, and there's a bar being built and this platform and the stage comes out at angles. And reason that I brought up my grandfather is because my grandfather was an architect and he was on my mind because I walked into that space and I looked at it and I smiled because it's this phenomenal set. And I thought to myself, yep, Yep, he would get it. He would get it. And not only that, I remembered going to the Metropolitan Opera with him and seeing those Zeffirelli sets. And
wow, that would have been, I've only seen pictures of those sets. They looked amazing.
So part of that is the continuity, and whether it's an artistic continuity, whether it's a family continuity, whether it's a life continuity, that is what I try to bring into my work.
Yeah, that's really cool. So did you grow up going to theater a lot? You said you went with your grandfather.
I did. I went with my parents. I went to theater and film. And my parents, they never, you know, they didn't expose us to, you know, the horrors of society as children, but they didn't censor us either. So wasn't so important that the movie was a PG R. It was the content of the movie, and they didn't shy away from things. I mean, there's some racy stuff. One of the earliest films I remember my father taking me to, where I began to have a little bit of a didactic shift in my own viewing, was the Coppola film Rumblefish, based on the S.E. Hinton novel, which was shot in black and white. There's some teenagey and adult and esoteric concepts in that film that I remember as a young child being exposed to, and taking that and then tracking that through a playwright like Sam Shepard, because there is some overlap. I mean, as different as Fellini and Shepard are in their own stark and lush ways, there is some overlap.
Yeah, that's interesting. We weren't really sheltered from watching things either. I'm sure we watched our movies right before most parents would allow kids to watch our movies. Not movies, but we watched Woodstock all growing up. Yeah, we know how to make a pipe out of aluminum foil because they show it in Woodstock, but it just wasn't. None of us went into drugs. None of us sell drugs. None of us have been to jail because of it, but it just wasn't sheltered for us. And then I hear people today who come to see a show at our theater, and one lady got mad because they said shit. And I'm like, how old's your kid? They're like 13. I'm like, that kid knows that word and way more words just by going to school or being outside in the world.
Yeah.
And I feel sometimes they're a little too sheltered.
Yeah, and there are lessons to learn along the way. I mean, I grew up about an hour and 15 minutes outside of New York City in Connecticut. I was born in the city. My parents are New Yorkers. My mom was originally from Brooklyn and then later New Rochelle. My father was from the Bronx. But I was raised in Connecticut primarily. But not so far out that by the time I was a teenager, I couldn't jump on the Metro train, see any show I wanted, and also get into a little bit of trouble. Not a lot. I mean, nothing, you know.
But any trouble that a normal teenage kid will get into.
I mean, at that time, at 15, you could buy beer at any bodega or restaurant you wanted to. But then you're not driving, so, you know.
If you're raised sensibly and you're like, well, I have a beer, but I'm not going to go drink five beers and get drunk and find myself in a hospital with alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, and I was also, I mean, like there's a healthy level of, I was also terrified of my parents. I mean, I come from that generation too, where, you know, I was terrified of my parents. I was terrified of my friends' parents. I was terrified of anybody who was an adult who could possibly derail my good time and my way of life, which was pretty sheltered and kind of odd.
But I think that's good, because then you're not being not necessarily afraid of them, but being to the point where in your head you hear mom say, what are you doing? And automatically you're like, oh, nope, not making that decision. You know, not doing that stupid thing because mom and dad are going to get mad at me and I don't want to do that.
Right.
You a healthy, like, you know, subconscious.
And for me, New York was a character in life. It was first romance with a city was New York. So New York was the first romance with a big city that I had, and that also informed why I went to college. I chose NYU because it was in the heart of the city, and it was in a part of the city that, you know, had a history of writers and poets, actors. This was where, if you're going to be an artist, you want to be Greenwich Village. Now, the city changes. I mean, my Greenwich Village was not the Greenwich Village of the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, and
very different time frame there.
And today's students aren't, they don't have my experience. I mean, when I was there, there was no Whole Foods. There was no, you know.
Starbucks wasn't on every corner. I think big cities are a big place that, or a place that a lot of arts people go because of that experience and shared experience with other people. Just like I think there's a very big reason why Picasso at Le Pinacle is based in Paris. Mm-hmm. I mean, Einstein's not French and Picasso's not French, but France and Paris was the art capital of the world. That's where artists went. And that's what, you know, they have that shared artistic vision. I know Einstein's not usually considered an artist, but he still was very creative and had to think outside of the box and kind of lived in that world too.
And the flip side of that coin is that sometimes the next decision is a more practical one. So the next artistic choice I made was, I have no idea post-college how I'm going to pay my bill live in the city.
Uh-huh.
And so I told to a friend of mine, wrote a letter of recommendation for me to go to a graduate school. So after I was at NYU, the next choice I made was to go to graduate school in Detroit. And I didn't choose Detroit. I didn't have intention of going to graduate school. It was simply a function of economics. I was working with somebody who said, I'll write you a letter of recommendation to the graduate school that I went to. It's a fellowship program. It's a free ride. In fact, they pay you to be there. Mm-hmm. And if you stick around in this fully functional theater company for 3 years, you walk away with an MFA. I said, well, there's no real downside to this. I guess I can go to the audition.
Yeah.
Well, the problem was, you know, do any research. I didn't, you know, look at any other schools or universities or any other graduate programs. I just said, okay, I'll go to this audition. I went, I got in, and then it was a question of, you don't know how you're going to function in New York and live in New York. You do have this offer to be in this city that you know nothing about with these people that you know nothing about and the potential for a free education. Okay, pack up the car and go. That's what I did. And that's where I met the producer of this show, and my artistic collaboration with Chris Gilbert began.
It's kind of funny because I didn't, well, I guess I kind of chose my grad school, but really it was like the only one that I got accepted to. So I was like, well, I guess I'm going to Cincinnati.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes that, you know, the lack of option gives you a clearer path and things will materialize along that path. So there are these infinite possibilities. I had a friend recently that's a little bit older, and he said that his son was trying to figure out whether or not to attend NYU, which is where I did undergrad work. And he was from Texas, and he'd gotten into some local schools, and the financial burden of, you know, being in New York was, he felt, might be too much, regardless of the number of loans or financial aid packages. And I said, you know, there are ways to do it that I didn't know about when I was that age. So I didn't know that you could go to a different university and go for the summer and take great theater classes or take, I didn't know that you could get your summer in New York and your NYU experience. And I thought I had to be there full time and all that. So there are ways to achieve even what you think you want in a different way. And I think that's that perspective. Maybe it comes with age, maybe it comes with experience. And maybe it just comes with the desire to explore some different ways of going about achieving your goals.
I think that's a big one because, like you said, the opportunity comes and you take it or you don't take it, or you really want something but you don't get the job or you don't get into that university. And it's just what you're willing to, you know, if you really want to get into that university, do you take other classes and get other recommendations and try again next year, or do you get into a different university and see where that leads you?
Right. And I had a friend that I met again at graduate school who had auditioned for a program through the Old Globe in San Diego, really wanted to be there, didn't get in, came to graduate school in Detroit, and then at the end of the year said, you know, what I really wanted was that school. I'm going to go back to New York. I'm going to spend a year studying, and I'm going to audition for that other program. And he did it. And he didn't get troubled or tripped up, but I've already put a year into another school. And he did it. He didn't get tripped up. Right out of grad school, got a couple of Broadway shows, developed an outreach and education program for young people in Africa, and takes artists over there to work with children. And he said, I never would have thought this, but like my day job is occasionally jobbing into a Broadway show or doing a couple episodes of Boardwalk Empire or whatever. Passion is teaching kids in Africa. And I just never would have known that. And so, you know, had he stayed in Detroit, that path would not necessarily have occurred to him. Had he gotten into the Old Globe mm-hmm. program the first time around, that may not have occurred to him. But life took the path it did, and he was able to, you know, find himself in the new path.
Yeah, and that's just because he was willing to, wanted to go there, so he did, and he tried different things before he got there, and... Yeah, you never know.
Which is not to say that I don't have my type A moments. I mean, I'm actually, I sound fairly relaxed and pretty chill.
This is all I've heard you do for the last couple weeks.
but that's also based on my directing style. My directing style is modeled after two people. We can get into that in a moment. But I make myself crazy and takes on everything until it's time to work. Then it's... relax, let's breathe, let's see what people are bringing to the table and sort all of this out, because it's all, and you know, it's all possible.
I think that's one of the things I love about working with you. You're like, oh, you know how to build a set? Great. You have an idea? Great. Let's work on it. Let's work together as a team. And it's very relaxing.
Here's the thing is, I'm never going to be better at your job than you. That's just a fact. I'm just not. So if I don't trust you and see, you're always going to bring something to the table that is more interesting and more well thought out and more creative than what I'm going to bring to the table on the same platform. So that's my philosophy in working with department heads, which is you're the head of a department. So you didn't get to be the head of the lighting department by, you know, sitting in the back, not answering questions. Like, I'm trusting that you know what you're doing. You're going to do is see the mess that I've put up and say, I know exactly what you're thinking, and let me help you achieve that. And so what, then I try to do that with actors as well, which is I have my idea, but if I tell them how to do it and what to do, for the most part, it inhibits their creative process. For the most part, it shuts them down, puts them in their head, and makes them try to achieve a result that feels unnatural. And so for me, it's like, look, where are you coming from? I can tell you all day long where I'm coming from. I can tell you how I think, why I think, what I think, because I try to be a conscientious director. I try to be a conscientious person. But it's more interesting to me to see, like, what are you bringing to the table? Let's work with that, because we're already starting from a better place.
Yeah, and I feel that that makes the people feel better too. Like if when I crew, I don't tell them exactly how to build a flat. I assume they know how to build a flat. That's why they're here. And if they figure out how to build the flat on their own and they can build it on their own, they feel better about the outcome. They feel more confident. They feel more of a team player and not just, you know, a lackey who does whatever somebody else tells them. And then they think more and they feel more involved and they feel more part of the process.
Yeah, I'm not Orson Welles and I'm not Hitchcock. I'm not a genius. I mean, let's just put it out there. I know it's a debatable point, but I am not a genius. And I think there are people whose visions are strong enough and their personality is strong enough that the preparation that they do really for them, the work for them is the preparatory writer. Let's craft this. Let's meet with the designers. Let's craft that. Let's meet with wardrobe and craft that. And then the work is done. And actually doing it somewhat exercise in frustration. This didn't work the way I said. Let's do it again until it works the way I said. With this way, and that's kind of to the way that I work, although I appreciate some of those results. It's not that I dismiss the way of working, it's just not who I am. So for me to try to do that would be disingenuous to the work that I'm trying to elevate.
If you're not enjoying it and liking it, then why?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I mean, it's a collaborative art form, or at least it's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be, yeah. That's how I feel. You can't just put one person on stage. I mean, you could, but then if they don't have lights and they don't have someone selling the tickets and they don't have a microphone and they don't have costumes, like, kind of boring.
Yeah,
it works together.
And I think it's that thing of like, you know, you can lay the foundation and you can do street theater where there's no lights, no music, no, and you can get some performers and then you can add some set piece. You add a couple of blocks. Maybe it's slightly more interesting. Some lights, some music, and all of a sudden magic happens. So it's not that at any step of the way, it's not a valid art form. It's a valid art form from the very beginning. No matter what you have, not, from nothing to, you know, just the person with, you know, in the nude, you know, black space, like from nothing to the most complicated, you know, pyrotechnics, there is the ability to explore and reveal something about the human condition at every level.
Rin, what are you doing? It sounds like you're vacuuming.
Making a smoothie.
No, I'm literally sitting in a completely silent apartment doing nothing.
That's weird. It sounded like you were vacuuming.
Loud.
Okay. Way to be complicated, twin.
It's interesting that you guys refer to each other as twin. Has anybody else brought that up?
Yeah, a couple people.
Yeah.
We didn't start that way. Well, I mean,
I think Russell started it.
Yeah, our brother started it in like junior high or high school.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, it's, you know, my mind goes to a place of symmetry and, you know, asymmetry and or didactic points and, you know, counterpoint. So that's fascinates me about the idea that you guys are doing this podcast and you're on opposite coasts and at the same world from a different perspective and different job in a different place, and yet your home base is the same. And then there's the DNA and the genetic material that's also, there's some overlap there.
Yeah, some overlap. We're identical, so it's technically the same, our DNA.
So you are actually identical twins?
Yeah.
Okay.
Correct. So technically our DNA is the same as twins, identical twins split, the egg and sperm split within 1 to 6 days after conception. If it takes much longer than that, then usually you're conjoined twins. So our DNA is the same, but of course you develop slightly different throughout.
Yeah, years. Of course. Yeah.
But yeah, that was one of the things where first I thought, hey, we should do a podcast because Kai listens to a lot of podcasts. And I was looking into it and I was like, a lot of podcasts have, it's about actors or it's about who's on Broadway. But nobody really talks about the backstage stuff. And since both of us do backstage stuff, I was like, great, you have connections out there, I have connections out here. We'd have a ton of people to talk to about it. And we decided to start a podcast. It took her a little longer to agree to it because she doesn't really listen to podcasts and no computers. And so she has to still sign on and figure out how to do some things. But we've always worked pretty closely together. I mean, we grew up, we had the same room, we shared the same clothes, we did theater together, most of our classes were together. So we're still very close. And so I feel that we come at things different on some things, but we also come at things kind of in the same direction, which also goes back to the nature versus nurture and how much was it one versus the other. Because we grew up together and because, you know, we joke, we share the same brain, it's a balance. So what I know, she kind of knows too, and what she knows, I kind of know too. So I can call a show and I can be a stage manager because, I mean, I was trained in it some, but because I work with her and because I talk to her and because it's easy to gather that information. But she also knows how to build a set and she knows how to read ground plans and she can tape a floor and she understands basic lighting and sound and stuff. So it's interesting because even though we do different jobs, we know the other one's job and I'm at it, but then we also know there's somebody there at any time of the day, any day of the week to call and say, hey, I need a cue sheet. Send me a rough draft of one of yours to work with what I need. Or she'll send me drawings and say, I need this to fit into a space. How soon can you turn this around in AutoCAD and send it back to me? So works together.
Which is great. I mean, you know, and in terms of those technical things, I found stage management to be most difficult element of theater. I mean, I found it to be I had to do it class to fulfill a requirement. And the director took pity on me. And, you know, it was supposed to be, you know, the show couldn't be less than 30 minutes. And she gave me like a show with like three cues. And I couldn't do it. I mean, it was, you know, I was so panicked. Yeah, sound QA, stand by. It was already done. I mean, by the time I could call, and I couldn't call it any earlier because...
You had to call it on time.
Yeah, because if you start calling it earlier, you got other cues and there's other things happening. And, you know, whoever's running the board, I found it so anxiety provoking. And it has nothing to do with organization. People say, well, that's really for people that are organized. It's
your brain has to think that way.
Yeah. It's structural. And I think that there's a difference between organization and structure. I know that they have some overlapping groundwork, but some structural stuff that you have to understand that goes beyond organized.
I think that Cindy really likes that part of it. She loves the... unfortunately, Cindy's computer keeps dying and she can only half talk, but I feel like I can answer enough for her. She loves the bigger picture and being able to plan and see and call the entire show. She loves sitting in the rehearsals and working with the director and getting all the communications back and forth. And she, I've never seen anyone more excited when she calls cues right for a show. Or she watches another person call cues and they all come right. I'm like, I can't tell. I'm not paying attention to that, right? I'm watching how the scene change is happening. Called so nicely. It was right on time. And I'm like, great. That actor, I can see him on stage. He's not supposed to, you know, he's in the wing, but I can still see him. And so you look at things differently. And I don't hate stage management. God, sitting in rehearsal every day sounds very boring. Well, and she loves doing that. And so it's different.
From a director point of view, and really from a personal point of view overall, stage manager is the most important person in the room.
Oh, I agree. As I mean, a TD, without, I need all my information to come through that person.
Without a doubt, director makes a lot of choices and is relationships and things that work and don't work. Stage manager is tracking all of that. What works, what doesn't work. Then there's a level of communication about sense of chaos. And, you know, unless you're that very structured and regimented director where if they, you know, don't hit that mark, then it's all over. That stage manager to say, I think they were there the last time. Remember, you had to recorrect them and shift them there because you don't remember. You know what's working and what's not working, but you possibly remember every aspect, everything that worked.
Because also you're looking at the feelings, the design, the relationship. The stage manager is looking at how are they walking on stage? What cost, if they're, you know, in heels, can they step on that? Can the light hit them from over there? I need to tell the designer. It's different parts of the brain, I think.
I've never been asked a question by a stage manager that I couldn't answer, which is a good stage manager knows what kind of ask the director. Verification. I think that must come with experience. It must come with being able to read people. But also... it allows the director to clarify for themselves. It's usually not stage manager, doesn't it? It's usually that the stage manager thought it through and they have to now explain it in a clearer way, which will crystallize for themselves and give them the ability to communicate that to a cast, to a designer. And that's a gift that... I understand why somebody would want to be that person. Yeah, I can't do it, but I understand it.
Yeah, I can't do it either. But she often talks about reading a room or being able to figure out what's going on in the room. You know, if actors are getting upset or if they're not understanding what the director is talking about, or conflict between two people, or when it's break time, or just so many things that she's attention to. But then also, you know, writing all the notes and getting information back and forth to be very different at than what you're looking at than somebody else is looking at. But it definitely all back to working together and collaborative, and it takes a bunch of people to put a show together.
Yeah. Yep, sure does. but that had me thinking about things like the different departments and things like, you know, we were talking earlier about, I like to walk into a space and say, okay, this is the space I'm working in. You know, this is the set I'm working on. These are the personalities and actors that have walked through the door. This is the grid that we have with these lights. This is what we're working with.
Uh-huh.
And let's all do what we can do. Let's all do what we do best, or what we have said we are passionate about. And we were talking earlier, I mean, a lot of my favorite work is not perfect work. A lot of my favorite work is flawed work with moments that are surprising or brilliant or take you in a different direction. And those are the things that I gravitate to. I love to see a great film, don't get me wrong, or a great play, and go out and experience that and clap and say, this was a great night at the theater. And yes, I saw that, whatever the big hit was or whatever it was. And technically it was beautiful and there wasn't a missed cue, and it was, the staging was amazing and the set was phenomenal. But there was something about that sloppy piece that, you know, they're going for the ephemeral. They've got that little thing they're going for. They may not get there, but they got there in a moment, or you saw the door open and that little bit of light creep through the door and you said, wow, that opened my perspective to something new.
Huh.
The rest of it didn't work. The rest of it was didn't work for me. But when everything is handed to you, disengage as an audience member, at least I do. When everything is handed to you, you can appreciate it, but you can't touch it. It's like looking at, you know, fine work of art in a museum, as opposed to going to the artist studio and running your hand across the marble.
Oh yeah, I want to touch everything.
Yeah, no,
just
exactly.
That physical, but to be that close and know it's a work in progress and it's still.
It's that tactile thing. It's also to be generous and to forgive people for their fallibilities and their faults, and to be human and to say it's okay.
Because nobody's perfect. So it's great to accept and acknowledge that nobody's perfect and see that as also beautiful and worthwhile.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you go and see a great production of, I don't know, I'm going to use this as an example. This is no diss on the work, because I actually, you know, I like everything, but, you go and you see a production of Phantom of the Opera, and it's glossy and it's nice. You sit back and you watch it. But that's how I feel about some of these movies. You sit back and you watch them. They come to you, you experience them, and then you leave. And it's not that they're instantly forgettable. There's some nice music. Maybe you revisit it. Maybe you have a conversation with somebody about it. But did you learn anything about yourself? Did you learn anything about the people that you were sitting next to? What was your interaction with that piece? Maybe it was an okay night at the theater, which is perfectly acceptable and fine and lovely, but that's not what I gravitate to.
Mm-hmm.
I gravitate to, you know, a few blocks over, second floor of a building. They decided to make whatever office space got condemned into a theater.
And, there's quite a few of those.
Yeah, and there should be. And figure out how to put up either a new work or a different take on a classic, or do a reading where they're just starting to scratch the surface and new things are revealed.
But I think a lot of people a lot of people start there to learn what they like, to learn what works, to learn, you know, how to do something different and new.
But isn't that it? I mean, like, we talked earlier about approaching things and my approach. I'm far from an Eastern guy, but there is something to be said for that Zen mind of the beginner's mind. You come at things as a beginner, and the whole world is possible as a beginner. You know, you don't know what shape is going to happen. The most exciting thing is the beginning.
Yeah, because it could go anywhere.
Once you get to the end, you could be full of regrets, you know, or your sense of accomplishment or a mixture of all of those things. But to be there at the beginning and to take each step, really kind of the magic of what we do. One of the things that I do want people to understand about the production of Picasso that we're doing is that it is not the Globe's production.
Yeah, it's nobody's production. It's a brand new set design, brand new everything.
It's a brand new production with a different concept. So if you've seen the show somewhere else, there is something here that will be different. There is something here for you that you might not anticipate and that will also offer, as good as any other production is, this will be different. And that's also something that's important to me, which is not to try to replicate somebody else's great production.
Yeah. You got to do something new and different. It's different actors. It's a different stage. It's a different set. Our set is brand new. We're currently building it right now. I don't know if any of these actors have played these parts before. They definitely haven't played them together. Right. So, I mean, so far the set looks amazing. Greg Fritchie, you know, great set design. We had the table read last week, and I was cracking up through the entire thing, and it's the first time they all sat down together to read it.
Yeah, it's
and already it was hilarious.
It's an amazing group of actors that are bringing their heart and soul to the piece, and they're working hard. We have a short process here at the theater, and it's amazing how much work you can get done. I always say to people, when they say, well, how long does it take to mount the show? I said, how long you got? And they say, what do you mean? I said, well, if you have a week, it takes a week to mount the show. If you have a month, it takes a month. How long do you have? Because that's how long it will take to develop the work.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been in a show where I'm like, oh man, we had way too much rehearsal time for this or way too much tech time for this. Sometimes you're like, yeah, the audience, you know, we need to get an audience because the actors will react differently. But never are we like, oh, we could open 3 weeks early. Like,
yeah, I mean, I've been a little bit early on a few things and peaked a little early. However, that being said, still the structure of the process where you want people to be and how you want that to go. You know, if you tell me we got to put something up in a different space in six hours, we could do it.
Yeah, because there's no other option. Like, audience is coming. That's what you have to do.
So how do we get our minds together? How do we figure out what we can do in this limited time? How do we put all of that together and present something? And that's really what all of us do as theater artists, which is, this is what we can do, and where do we expand and contract, and what elements would we like to bring into this? And I love it when somebody says, I can do that. I say, I know this is crazy, but I'm thinking about something like this. And they say, I can do that. In fact, I can do it better because I can do this, this, and this. And then all of a sudden I said, let's do that. Let's do what he said. Or let's do what she said.
Yeah, that sounds great. Let's go that way.
That's better than what I thought. and that's what I'm always looking for in the collaboration.
Yeah, because everyone has different ideas and have done different things and have different ways of looking at it. So it put things together and create something bigger and better than you could do by yourself.
So do we need to plug the dates here?
Or do we not? Yeah, I think we're going to release this 1 week before opening. Yeah, so we're releasing this Friday, okay, which is 2 days after we've recorded it, and we open on January 26th.
Friday the 26th at 8 p.m.
And I know tickets are on sale online. We always post links on, I tag us building the set constantly, so if you follow on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, you'll see links to Palos Verdes Performing Arts. You can buy tickets online, you can call in, you can buy them at the door, and we run for 2 weekends.
Yeah, 2 weekends.
Friday night, Saturday night, both at 8, Sunday at 2.
Right. And if you do have a chance to come out and see the show, you know, if you hang out, the actors come out, you can chat them up, tell them what you liked, what you didn't like.
I think Rusty's already said he's going to be here for most performances. You can find him.
Yeah, I'll tell him what you think. I'll be around, you know.
Yeah, and then if you come opening night, we have a little cast party afterwards. It's always fun to hang out with the actors, and everyone's excited because it's opening night and tech's done, and we have an audience, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, that'll be in not this Friday, but next Friday. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm so excited to have people come see the show that I liked after the first time read through.
Yeah, so come on out, experience the show. You know, I think we got a good night of theater for you, and stick around and say hi afterwards.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Rusties.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to Twins Talk Theater. If you would like more, please visit our website at twinstalktheater.podbean.com or on Facebook at Twins Talk Theater. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Google Play Music. Also, give us a review on iTunes and tell us what you liked about the show.